Welcome to week five. And today we're going to finish the details about the universe's design we didn't get to last week with verses that tell us about the design of our planet. And as I said earlier, contrary to some misinterpretation, Genesis 1 uses the terms heavens and earth. That phrase is called a merism. You put it together and it's a totality. It refers to the cosmos. So in the beginning, God created the cosmos. So it doesn't imply, as you may have heard, that the stars and the earth were created at the same time. The verses about the initial creation of our globe don't tell us when in the history of the universe's expansion that God created the earth, and neither does any other verse. As I've said earlier, the authors just don't seem to be interested in when this occurred like we are. They do give us detail about God's activity in forming our planet into a sphere. And then Genesis 1 will turn to how God fashioned this sphere and filled it for life. So the very ancient book of Job gives us information, basic information in chapter 9, verse 8, that the shape of the earth is round. The ancient Hebrew word translated circular there has the concept of drawing a circle with a compass, like you did in school. Solomon, quoting personified wisdom in Proverbs 8, told his audience, living much later than Job, that the earth is three-dimensional, using a word translated circle that means a sphere. So two different words used in these two different verses. This verse speaks to us of the wisdom of God that preceded the earth. Notice this verse also seems to refer to a time in earth's history when the earth was a water world and to God creating the water cycle and weather. And we'll look at those events and come back to this verse when we look at Genesis 1. That is the Proverbs 8, 27 through 28. You may have the wrong week. It's week 5. And I put when he drew a circle on the face of the deep.
Do you have week 5?
Did we run out?
Here's another one.
I've got an extra here. I made what I thought would be enough copies. I thought they made enough copies, but we'll do better next time. So then look at Isaiah 40. We looked at this verse last week, 21 and 22. Isaiah emphasizes the creator rather than the facts about the creation of the earth, and also uses the same Hebrew word translated circle, meaning sphere. His audience would already have been familiar with Job and Proverbs, so they'd already know the shape of the earth. He states this in the same two verses that tell us that the universe is expanding, which we looked at a number of those last week. And notice the verbs that he uses that just show how active God was in shaping our earth. He drew a horizon, he prepared the heavens, he drew a circle on the deep. And then the last verse I want to look at on the design of the earth is from Job 26, verse 7. You know, at a time when other ancient peoples believed that the earth rested on the back of something like a giant turtle or a giant man called Atlas, the author of Job tells us in a poetic way in verse 7 that the earth is in fact suspended in space by God. Again, the emphasis in all of these accounts is on the Creator. So they're on the Creator and who He is, rather than just telling us details about what was created and when. Now, you may be thinking, remembering, that some people in the Middle Ages argued that the earth was flat, and they used a scripture to support that idea. That scripture said that the earth was established on a firm foundation, and so they interpreted that literally like a foundation of a house. The history of science course I listened to said that at the time, the writings of Aristotle had been rediscovered. And many intellectuals of the day were enamored by his wisdom. And Aristotle believed the earth was flat. So apparently, they believed that must be true. They obviously didn't go to the Bible and see what the Bible said about the shape of the earth. The Bible, as we've seen in a lot of verses, the Bible and the record of nature agree with each other, as we would expect they would because they have the same author. But as I've said, the intent of the Bible is to tell us who God is and why we exist, not to look at things like a scientist would. Science only been around the last 400 or 500 years for one reason. I put in a quote from Galileo, who was an early scientist around that time, and he said, "The Bible tells us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go." All right, so we've talked about how the biblical creation accounts are radically different in concept from content from the pagan creation accounts of that day. And today we want to start seeing how the biblical creation accounts are similar to those accounts. Look at both sides of it. To understand that similarity, though, we first have to try to put ourselves into the way they thought. It's a way of thinking that's completely different from the way we think, and it pervades the entire Old Testament. Understanding how ancient people thought compared to how we think of reality today will help us understand this text and other texts. And then I want to remind you of just how different the biblical accounts are in terms of content. Don't just take my word for it. I want to read you some excerpts from a couple of creation accounts, just so you can see the content and compare it to Genesis 1. And then we'll look at the style the authors used to write narrative accounts and why they wrote the accounts this way. And then we'll look again at Genesis 1:1. And next week, we'll look at the big picture of Genesis 1. I want you to be able to see the whole big picture and structure. And then we'll begin to look at it line by line with some other verses. And I'll introduce you to some more tools to help you understand the Old Testament. Last week, the first tool I introduced you to was the importance of repetition. When you see things being repeated, it's pointing you to a theme, a meaning, a subject. Okay, so the Old Testament is written in a long-dead language, ancient Hebrew. But that's not our only problem in trying to understand the meaning. We also don't understand the culture and the way these ancient people thought. We in the Western world came out of ancient Greek and Roman thought. The New Testament was written in ancient Greek, not ancient Hebrew, and it's based on logic. And that better matches the way we think about reality, given our cultural background. The Old Testament, particularly Genesis, is around, 1,500, 2,000 years older than the New Testament, and it's not grounded in the Greek way of thinking. So it's more of an effort for us to put ourselves in their sandals, so to speak, and understand what they're saying. So I think it's important for us to get a handle on what the audience would have been thinking. Israel is part of what's called the ancient Near East. So their way of thinking is not just different to those of us living in the last few hundred years this side of the Enlightenment after the beginning of science. It's also more Eastern than Western. The Oriental or Eastern mind is very different from the Western mind even today. I was once at a meeting with company presidents from all over the world, and the group was talking about doing business in China. And a man from Beijing was laughing that American companies sent Chinese Americans to their Chinese subsidiaries to better relate to the culture. But the Chinese recognized that they thought like an American, not a Chinese. They may have looked the same on the outside, but they were Western, not Eastern, and very different on the inside. He said that in China, they call these Chinese Americans bananas. They are yellow bananas. They are yellow on the outside and white on the inside. So that's the difference in the way of thinking, even today. But he also said there are some white Americans who've lived in China and really understand the way they think, and they're easier for the Chinese to work with. And he said they call them eggs. They're white on the outside and yellow on the on the inside. I also worked with a doctor from China who was a scientist with a PhD. He'd lived in America for a long time, but he also had a very different perspective from mine that I saw best when he was practicing his hobby of photography. His perspective on a landscape, for example, was exactly backwards from mine. I try to take a picture with the entire landscape in focus. I may even use the panoramic view at times. This Chinese photographer, like a lot of Oriental artists, if you start looking at their art, would focus in on a blade of grass in the foreground, and the whole landscape in the background would be blurred. And out of focus. So there are different yet acceptable ways of looking at reality in our world today. If you've visited other countries, even Western or European countries, you've probably noticed how different cultures think differently about what's important or true. I try to, when I travel, part of the fun is getting into the culture, live my life the way they live. And when you do that, you notice the differences. And frankly, we may at times feel that their way of living and approaching life is stupid because, of course, the way we think and behave is right and correct. but these cultures seem very happy with the differences that we observe. As an example, Americans take it as a given that the customer is always right. That's just not believed to be true in the rest of the world. And it's an American attitude. I mean, we believe it to be universally true. You can see American behavior when they don't believe it come out because it's just the way it is to us. And these other cultures just don't get what seems so obvious to us. What seems obvious to us is just as foreign to them. So to understand the Old Testament, we need to understand the differences in the way people thought, not just in an Eastern mindset, not just in a different culture, but the way they thought in the ancient world compared to the way we think in the Western world, particularly after the Enlightenment. And that'll be a difficult task. But spending some time on this today, I think, will make it easier to understand Genesis when we start looking at it line by line. So, as I said, the cognitive environment in the ancient Near East, very different from our own. The Bible communicates in a way that all people throughout time have experienced the cosmos before the modern day. So I want you today to try to put yourself back in time when everyone would have shared a common understanding of what was real. And I've put a number of those on your handout. And it could not be more different from the way we think. So first, the term natural world would be meaningless or nonsensical to everyone in the ancient world. There was nothing about the world that was natural. There was no purely natural cause and effect, no natural laws, no natural occurrences. Everything was involved with the supernatural. We think of nature as an it because the Bible presents nature as an it. But that's not the way the ancient world thought. That wasn't that environment at the time. In the ancient Near East, gods came into existence by being given a name and a function or a jurisdiction in some area. So existence is really much more closely bound with function and role. So the sun god, for example, did not create the sun. He had no existence separate from, outside of, or apart from the sun. That's hard to understand. You know, we think of things coming into existence when there's some material something, right? They didn't. It was all about being given a function and a role. And so that's the next area that's really, I think, the hardest. I have to kind of remind myself at times how differently they think in this area of substance versus function. We in the modern world are substance-oriented. In the ancient Near East, something did not necessarily exist just because it happened to occupy space, which just seems odd, right? Something did not exist just because it occupied space, just because it had a material substance. That seems so odd to us because our whole way of thinking is things exist when there's a thing there that you can see and, you know, touch, right? This is the biggest difference in trying to put myself back into the ancient world, because we have a material definition of cosmos. They had a functional one based on order. There's no language for creation anywhere in the ancient Near East that focuses attention solely or even primarily on things. So our natural approach to Genesis 1 is to think of material objects. When we're reading it, they wouldn't. I know. We kind of have puzzled looks on our faces. It's just different. And if we don't understand this difference, then we're going to say, well, why didn't Moses write it like this? And why did he say it that way? And he's talking to people with this mindset. Yes. See, in the Bible, things are real in substance. That's something new that the Bible introduced, is that reality is real. The physical reality is real.
They believe Adam and Eve were real people,
right?
Right.
Okay. Right. And the New Testament, Paul, Jesus, so forth, speak of them as real.
Real people.
Yes. And in fact, you may not remember this, but Time Magazine had two head covers years ago when Time Magazine was worth something. And the one cover was they had discovered Eve, and the other cover was they had discovered Adam, because genetically we all go back to one man and one woman. And so they named them Adam and Eve. I digress. No, that's okay. I kind of went farther than the explanation. Yes.
Okay, so if something did not necessarily exist just because it happened to occupy space, did they think the opposite was true as well, that something that could not occupy space but still exist?
Yeah.
Okay. What was that question?
Yeah. They would think the opposite was true as well. Not as prominently, but I can see that. But now, let me just comment that coming from the Greek world, we think if A equals B, then B equals A. Mm-hmm. That's Greek. That's logical.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So when the Apostle John says, you know, if you confess your sin, he's faithful and just to forgive us our sins, we might want to say, well, then if we don't confess, he doesn't forgive. He's not really saying that. He's saying what he said.
Yeah.
Right? And we want to read the opposite into it. The Apostle Paul does that.
Yeah.
Because he's got that Greek-Roman. Okay. So, yeah. All right. So the cosmos to them would be ordered. They were all about order. They want society to be ordered. The cosmos needs to be ordered. In the ancient world, to create something would mean to give it a function or role within an ordered cosmos. So to describe creation is to describe the establishment of the functioning cosmos, not the origins of the material structure or substance. They were not concerned about it. Whatever the physical structure, it just wasn't a priority to them. Material substance just didn't have any importance or relevance to their understanding of the world. That is so hard for us to get, because this side of science, our whole way of thinking is oriented around what's the sun made of? You know, is it helium? Is it hydrogen? Blah, blah, blah. They just want to know, what time of day does the sun tell us it is? What's the season? See, its role and its function. And then in the pagan world, they thought a god you know, regulate all that. Yes.
It was tied to survival. I mean, you know, when you plant, when you eat, how do we get through it? How do we survive
tomorrow? I think it was tied to survival. I think it was tied to experience. It was just how you experienced the, how you explain the world, how you experience the world, right? So to describe creation is to describe the establishment of the functioning cosmos, not the origins of the material structure or substance. Whatever the physical structures of the heaven, as I said, it's not a priority. So then in number 7 there, in the ancient world, something exists when it has a function, not when it takes up space or is a substance characterized by material properties. So this applies to everything in the cosmos where various elements come into being when they're given a role and function within the cosmos. As I said, they didn't wonder what the sun was made of. It told time of day. It provided light. It marked the seasons. That was its role and function as they experienced it in their life. The neglect of curiosity about the physical structure of the cosmos is really not just a consequence of their inability to investigate their physical world and that science hadn't been invented yet. The physical aspects of the cosmos did not define its existence or its importance. And this was true of, people until 400 or 500 years ago. So most of humanity's existence. The purposes of the gods were of prime importance to them. So then let's finally look at two things that will help us when we, really more next week when we get into Genesis 1-2, but also when we're looking at the similarities between Genesis and these myths of the ancient Near East. Since the Greek word cosmos implies order, it might be best to use the term pre-cosmic. So the pre-cosmic condition is not lacking in what was material. It was lacking in order and differentiation. So the accounts regularly begin with a pre-cosmic, unordered, non-functional world. This is why I started us on the creation of the universe by looking in the New Testament at Hebrews 11:3, right? Because we could look at that as a substance and everything coming into existence. But now I'm taking us back into the Old Testament and that Greek thought, that logical thought, doesn't apply. So the accounts begin with a pre-cosmic, unordered, non-functional world. And then creation takes place by giving things order, function, and purpose, which is to them, remember, is synonymous with giving it existence. Ancient sources are unanimous that the pre-cosmic condition included water and darkness. We'll see that those same initial conditions where Moses chooses to begin his account. It's where his audience would expect a creation account to begin. All right. So now let's look at the similarities between Genesis and ancient Near East views of origins. And let's start with the famous Mesopotamian, I don't know how to pronounce this, Enuma Elish?
Elish.
Thank you. And let's compare the ancient Near East views of how the world came to be and presently works side by side with the Bible. Both Mesopotamian and Egyptian creation accounts and the Bible assume primeval chaos, primeval water, and primeval darkness and have an almost identical sequence of events. So you can see divine spirit and cosmic matter coexist in both of accounts, but then the content in Genesis is different. In the pagan view, divine spirit and cosmic matter were co-eternal. We saw in Hebrews 11:3 that's not true. God existed before he created the universe. So again, content differences, but they start, you know, with that. Some similarities. They both start in chaos, and then there's light emanating from the gods, and in Genesis, light appears before the luminaries. There's creation of the firmament or sky, and it involves separation of water above and water below in both both types of creation accounts. And then just look at the parallels, creation of dry land, creation of luminaries, creation of man, the gods rest and celebrate, and in Genesis, God rests and sanctifies the seventh day. Now, the Egyptian account is not as parallel. I mean, these people are Semitic, so they lived before the slavery in Egypt in that Mesopotamian world, but there are some similarities to the Egyptian account. Again, you have primeval waters, darkness, and chaos, and that's already in existence when their accounts start, which parallels Genesis 1-2 that we'll look at next week. But then it differs. You know, they view a seed that the world comes from, like a plant, they're not the strict parallels you see in Mesopotamia. But the last item there, in later Egypt, the ordered structure of the cosmos came into being by a deity speaking it, effective word, and we'll see the cosmos is ordered by the word of God over and over and over again. So there are a couple of parallels with Egyptian. So the skeleton of the structure is virtually the same, particularly to the Mesopotamian accounts. The biggest similarities, the conception of an immense primeval body of water already in existence. The idea that the creation of the firmament or sky involved the separation of waters. The existence of light before luminaries and the partial similarities of a structural outline. They also present creation in a plot structure or story. So that's the same. In Genesis 1, God is the protagonist who achieves his goal, peaking with the creation of human beings, followed by the protagonist resting. So it's basically told as a story. So the people in the biblical stories, when we read them throughout the Old Testament, they're not so different from us. But again, in the way they look at the world is a product of their culture. And as I've said, God doesn't require them to leave their culture for salvation. He meets them where they are within their culture and their ability to, frankly, to understand. You know, I don't know if you remember the movie Hawaii. Missionaries from Victorian England did not do this. They did not. They went into primitive culture like Hawaii at the time, and, you know, if they became Christians, they had to dress in, you know, the high neck starchy suits that they wore in England. They tried to make them be part of Victorian England culture. In fact, a lot of people today still confuse Christianity with Victorianism. But so God meets these people where they are within their culture. And, you know, if God had presented the creation accounts the way that would make sense to us post-Enlightenment, they would have just rejected it as nonsense. And we're fooling ourselves if we believe that we would think about the reality the way we do today. If God hadn't entered into their world to reach them, there's no reason to suppose that science would have been invented outside of Western Christian Europe with its biblical worldview of nature and an orderly God operating according to laws and so forth, because it was never invented before. We talked about all the smart peoples that could have invented science. As one philosopher said, it was stillborn in every other culture. So, you know, mankind needed the basic information about reality, both spiritual and physical, to even reach the way we think today. But as C.S. Lewis said, we're kind of historical snobs and just, you know, think we're better than they were. But today we're trying to put ourselves back into their shoes. Yes?
So you're saying the similarities between those is so that people would understand, so teaching in a language they would understand. So I'm trying to figure out how I'm asking this question. I guess that's it. Like you're saying, because that was my question before you started, what you were just saying was, how do you explain the similarity, or what do you interpret the similarities?
Yeah, that's the way I interpret the similarities.
That this was
the structure, the form was what the people would expect. But none of the content was the same. So God's giving them radically new content, radically new. But he gives it in a way that they could be comfortable and listen and accept that radically new concept. Yes?
So
It's also, it's like he's writing it where it's true for all times.
That's a very good point.
It's true for them, but we look into it and it's true for what we know.
Right, so right. We can look at it with our mindset, and it's written to where it's an accurate, truthful picture of what happened. Now, it's kind of amazing. I don't know how they could do that. But if we try to put our modern mindset on Genesis, then we get into some controversies about, you know, when this and how that, and, you know, and they're talking about role and function. Now, you know, with my science background and my very interested in truth, I'm obviously, as we go through Genesis 1, going to say, okay, was this condition ever true? Is this just made up? Is it fiction? And it's not. I'll give you a preview of coming attractions.
Yeah.
But obviously that's of interest to me. And you're right. It's how do you present this information to people who are so different where they could accept it,
yeah,
and get the content, the message of who God is, who they are, what God's plan is. I mean, he's writing for salvation and to develop a relationship with a people, right? But he has to start somewhere. If you were a missionary today going into a primitive tribe, you'd have the same kind of how do I present this? Yes.
Probably why many countries is happening, but in Japan, Christianity was just almost completely snubbed out, or like maybe
it never started, right?
Because it didn't incorporate the beliefs of the Japanese.
Right. It didn't put it in a way they could understand, like the difference between that Oriental mind and the Western mind. There are ways to present it, and the way the Bible does it, you know, reaches people different ways. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm.
So I go to their house and, you know, play the little organ for their services. But what got to me later on was it was kind of a crisis of faith, because I felt like it was a good family. Their intentions were good, just like the person in the movie Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
His intentions were good, but it seemed like to me the premise was to these Japanese people. And I lived with a Japanese family.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese, of course.
So you were in the culture.
I was totally in the culture.
Yes.
It was a Japanese home. It was not Western.
Mm-hmm.
Or Japanese, all that, trying to, you know, but that they were trying to tell the Japanese that came to these services, your way of thinking, my college, I was a senior in college, so
right?
So your way of thinking is wrong. My way of thinking is right.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that, you know, the
so they pushed back, right?
Well, it was like saying everything you believe, same story to Hawaii, everything you believe is just not true. You know, that's what my senior college little mind thought. Wait a minute, this doesn't seem, and I was a Baptist, this doesn't seem right. Who are we to be arrogant, to go into a culture and say, everything you believe for centuries is not true. We are true. And I was thinking, wait a minute, and it was a huge crisis of faith.
Right.
I thought, wait a minute, God, this doesn't seem right. This just doesn't seem right.
Well, so,
but ethically and morally.
Right. But when God's talking to the ancient Israelites in the wilderness, they've been in slavery for 400 plus years. They fell into paganism. I guess Joshua said they were worshiping the pagan gods. God had to give them totally new information. None of that was true. But so Moses did it using this narrative style and a lot of similarities, not asking them to leave their culture. But he does give them new information. Now, he doesn't do it by saying blah, blah, blah's, you know, false. He's basically showing them the truth. But the narrative style actually helps you accept that new information without pushing back. And so we'll talk about that in a minute. Yes.
It does seem like there's very stories in the Old Testament where they kind of say there are other gods, but God is like the king god.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Some of the other cultures would have kind of a king god that then started other gods, but they're very different from God. Even that, was it Ammon or whatever in Egypt, still pantheism, you know, so forth.
It makes me wonder, like, is that true, that there are other gods? Like, even the wording in the Ten Commandments is like, you shall have no other gods before mm-hmm. me, would make you think, well, then there's got to be others if it's possible for us to have them before you, or is that just him?
So the Apostle Paul basically said our problem as fallen man is we worship the creation instead of the creator. And that's what that is. You're not supposed to worship the creation. You're not supposed to make a god out of anything in creation, even self, right? There are some verses, and I'll try to find them, that imply that maybe there's some fallen angel demonic activity behind some of these other gods. And you see some language that implies that. I don't think we can say that definitely. Yes?
But Paul dodges that when he goes, speaks to the Greeks. He says, you know, you have all these other gods, but the gods you don't know about, that's the one I'm going to tell you about.
Right, right. So this is he dodges it. He says, this is the unknown God. So he goes into their culture.
Yeah,
he meets them where they are.
Everybody else.
He begins to give them new content. But notice when they reject him. Because in ancient Greece, right, reality wasn't real, right? There was spiritual and physical. And think about, in these pagan cultures, matter and reality had a very bad beginning. I'm going to read you a couple of stories to drive that home. But it wasn't good. And so the Greeks had this spiritual matter kind of reality. And it was when he said that Jesus became a man, the incarnation, that's when they laughed and left. You know, so again, that was just totally foreign to their concept of reality. But yeah, Paul was much smarter than the Victorian missionaries, than the Japanese missionaries, right? Right. Okay, so that's the similarities. Just to remind you of the differences between the biblical accounts and the pagan accounts, I want to read a couple of excerpts from a couple of different pagan accounts, just so you can see the content differences. I will warn you, these are earthy people, and the descriptions may be somewhat earthy for us. they speak of body parts, is kind of basically what I'm saying. So from the Babylonian Genesis, the Enuma Elish, Elish. Tiamat leads a formidable host of demons against her children. These were not good gods. No moral god before the God of the Bible. And you'll just see that. The young god Marduk comes to their defense. And when Tiamat opens her mouth to devour Marduk, he is represented as breaking wind in Tiamat's face. And she opens her mouth wide to swallow the wind dispatched from his rear, whereupon he shoots arrows at her and deflates her. After defeating the demonic army, Marduk returns to the huge corpse of Tiamat to establish order, the cosmos. From later in a new text, then it says, taking the spittle of Tiamat, Marduk formed the clouds and filled them with water. Putting her head into position, he formed the mountains, opening the deep, which was in flood. See, that's that primeval water. He caused to flow from her eyes the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers. He formed at her udder the lofty mountains. Her crotch, she was fastened to the heavens. Thus he covered the heavens and established the earth. Different content, right? I mean, very different. You just see how high, sophisticated Genesis is. From a Babylonian text on the origin of the gods were paired, male and female, the first two being Hain and Earth. The two brought into existence two other gods, Amanaku and Si. And then Amanaku, the Earth, the mother, said to Amanaku, her son, come, I'll make love to you. And so he married Earth, his mother. He killed his father. Then he took the lordship of his father, and he married the sea, his sister. And then one divine pair succeeds another just by means of incest and murder and so on. So the content is very different. So I think our time is gone. I'm going to pick up there next time. And we'll talk about narrative and why telling the story that way was able to reach people. I mean, it appeals to our emotions. It appeals to our whole person, our imagination, not just our mind. And then we'll start looking at Genesis. I want to give you a big overview of Genesis next week, too.